Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past 4 following news, Kirk Heinze broadcasts from the Michigan Agribusiness Association's Winter Conference.
Greening of the Great Lakes was recently on site at the Michigan Water Symposium in downtown Lansing. Organized by the Michigan Agribusiness Association, the symposium focused on water quality and management issues in the Great Lakes and across the U.S. We'll talk to water management experts from as far away as California and Nebraska who have lessons to convey about how we can better preserve our precious Great Lakes water resources.
And we'll learn about farmers who are applying just the right amount of fertilizers and herbicides and doing so only when necessary. MSU Today begins at 4:06.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, Russ and I are in downtown Lansing today at the Michigan Water Symposium, which is organized by the Michigan Agribusiness Association as part of their 2016 Winter Conference and Trade Show. Over the next hour, we'll be talking with several of the featured speakers from across the United States, but let's start with frequent guest and president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association, Jim Byram. Jim, always a pleasure to see you on the show.
Dr. Heinze, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
This year, a whole day of water-related issues. Why so important? Why so much emphasis on the water?
Well, that's the elephant in the room when it comes to basically any industry in the state of Michigan today. Certainly the governor wants to have water as a bit of a legacy. I don't think he wants it to be Flint water. Would rather have it be Great Lakes water. And that's what we're focused on, is water quality and water access. We have friends in that you'll be talking about the water issues in the Ogallala Aquifer and the Central Valley and other valleys in California, just to give a focus on some of those challenges to water access that maybe we haven't seen as clearly here as they have in some other areas, but we need to be aware of them and need to be focused on water access. And then water quality, it goes without saying that water quality, Western Basin, Lake Erie issues, some of the challenges in Lake Macatawa, as well as the Saginaw Bay, it's all about water in this state. It seems a little bit ridiculous that we're surrounded by fresh water and we're putting this much emphasis on it, but we want to keep it, want to maintain it, and want it to be a sustainable resource.
We are in a situation, as you mentioned, water abundance here in Michigan, but we have a lot that we can learn from the California situation and the Nebraska Ogallala situation as well. I mean, we probably are where they were maybe 15 or 20 years ago.
Well, and we have, of course, more of it, which is a real win, and we don't rely on annual snowfall in the mountains as they do in California, at least in Northern California, for water resources. And Ogallala, clearly it's overpumping, it's overuse. Sustainability is important when we talk about water resources, and that's really what we're focused on here, is we want to use water. Water's only a resource if you use it, so we need to use it for agriculture, use it for industry, use it for recreation, all those critical opportunities. But at the same time, we want to be able to have the next generation and the generation after that experience some of those same kinds of opportunities.
Jim, one of the things that's going on in California because of the crisis there, a lot of folks are talking to each other who didn't talk to each other before. Environmental groups are talking with the mayors of cities. The mayors of cities are talking with the agricultural people. I mean, people are getting around the table. With respect to the Great Lakes and particularly Lake Erie, we need to be doing some of that same sort of thing.
We need to blow up some silos. There's way too many environmental groups that talk to each other. There's way too many agricultural groups and agricultural interests that talk to each other. And there's way too many, quite frankly, nonprofits and federal agencies and state agencies that do a great job of talking to each other. And we need to bridge some of those divides and bring some of those unique partnerships together, which we're working on pretty aggressively right now. The challenge is there are legitimate concerns from some of these other groups that maybe agriculture won't like. And likewise, there's concerns we may have with cities that the cities and the urban areas aren't going to like our concerns there. But if we're going to solve these issues, solve water quality issues in particular, it has to be a holistic approach. It can't be isolated. It can't just be a situation related to wastewater treatment in a city. We have to talk about urban runoff. We have to talk about agricultural issues like runoff and fertilizer use and nutrient loading. We have to talk about drain tile management. We have to talk about all that stuff. Every one of those is an uncomfortable conversation, but avoiding it doesn't make it go away.
Well, I remember 30 years ago or so, and I'm going to date myself a little bit here, but you couldn't get people on the environmental organizations from those organizations in the same room with a lot of agricultural folks, let alone mayors of urban cities. The whole thing has changed, and we don't have to necessarily wait for crisis for this to happen. Unfortunately, that's what happened in California.
Well, and we had a crisis here in the Western Basin, Lake Erie, that's quite frankly causing some of this renewed emphasis on cooperation. And one of the great adages that I love to quote frequently is never waste a good crisis. So use that crisis to build some new bridges, build some new coalitions, create new opportunities, and look to the future. You know, there's not a lot of Aggies left out here in the countryside. We're less than, what, 1.5-2% of the population, and we do a great job of talking to ourselves. While we think that's unique, my sense is urban mayors and urban interests do the same thing. We need to be talking to each other, not over each other or avoiding each other.
Obviously, you're featuring water at your winter conference and trade show. What are you hearing from your board of directors and your members with respect to these issues of water as they look to the future?
Well, I'll give you a little bit of focus on what we're doing. For example, at this conference, in addition to the water symposium, on Monday we kicked off our first voluntary certified fertilizer application program, where we had 270 people sitting in training, a day-long training, talking about fertilizer application technology, the latest in fertilizer application, as well as awareness of some of those water quality issues. We're doing that on a voluntary basis, but the irony is we are going to have more people certified in Michigan as fertilizer applicators than they do in some of those states that are requiring it as a mandatory program. We're pretty proactive here. We need to lead, be ahead of the curve, and do things in advance of some of that regulatory burden. You know, and that speaks to the issue of government is important in this whole equation and all these issues and all this discussion. But quite frankly, the private sector is going to lead the way. We just need to make sure that we don't have others get in the way of the private sector doing what's right. Because, frankly, when it comes to the private sector engaging in fertilizer use and adapting new technologies, you know, the governor a few months ago said we want to reduce phosphorus fertilizer or phosphorus loading in water bodies by 40%. In the last decade, we reduced phosphorus loading 40%. We've already done that. We'll do it again. But it's going to take the private sector engaging and really coming to the table, and we're there.
It's interesting, your point about the private sector leading the way. It's not just on water, but virtually every sustainability issue that we talk about on this program, our experts are saying, ultimately, it's the private sector, some of the major corporations who are going to lead the way in alternative energy, water, you name it.
No question about it. In fact, that's been the focus of our conversation Monday and Tuesday at this conference is, okay, is it regulation that's going to move the industry towards cage-free egg production? Is it the public sector or legislation that's going to move the pork industry toward lower antibiotic use or gestation-free pork production? Is it the government agencies or legislature that's going to move away from RBST? No, that didn't happen. It was the private sector, usually a marketing decision driven by a marketing effort, but also sustainability that moves those companies that are trying to sell their products to the general public, that moves those moves in that direction. We're seeing that more and more. In fact, one of my common statements and one of the things I always talk about is the private sector is going to move and change agricultural production more, and already has in the past 5 to 10 years. It's going to change it more in the next decade than anything we do with government regulation.
Well, Jim, thanks for the hospitality. As always, Russ and I are very much enjoying the Michigan Water Symposium. I've been talking with Jim Byram, who's the president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. They are hosting the Michigan Water Symposium in downtown Lansing. Jim, always a pleasure having you on the program.
Great to be with you. And, you know, even though we talk a lot about Michigan State, the irony is in this one, we need to go blue a little bit and maintain that high-quality water we have in this state.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Kirk Heinze is broadcasting from the Michigan Agribusiness Association's Winter Conference. Here's Kirk with more.
Well, continuing our coverage from the Michigan Water Symposium in downtown Lansing, another one of the featured speakers is David Ulrich. David has been a guest on this program before. He is the executive director of the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. David, tell us a little bit about the work of the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative.
Well, we are a group of 120 Great Lakes and St. Lawrence mayors, both from Canada and the United States. We were formed in 2003 under the leadership of then-Mayor Daley of Chicago. And shortly after that, Mayor David Miller of Toronto got involved. We were formed for three basic reasons, and Mayor Daley told me in no uncertain terms this is what we were going to do. Number one, he wanted seats at Great Lakes and St. Lawrence decision-making tables for cities. Number two, he wanted a strong best practices network that people could share some of the best ideas about what is the best way to take care of cities and the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence. And third, he wanted Ottawa and Washington to pay more attention to these resources. So those were the marching orders. We started with a real focus on water quality, water quantity, and waterfront vitality. But actually, thanks to the leadership of Mayor Hartwell out of Grand Rapids, we really expanded into a more comprehensive sustainability agenda where we look at economic, social, and environmental issues.
Now, you mentioned that you have over 120 mayors involved in this, but they range all the way, I would imagine, from the city of Chicago up to, what, Quebec, and all the way to the Atlantic Ocean.
Absolutely. We sneak out a little bit there on the Gaspé Peninsula. Gaspé is a member, and Rimouski and Sept-Îles, way out in Quebec, and then Duluth, Thunder Bay, Nipigon are members. Big cities, small cities, north, somewhat south. And it's a good group of people representing over 17 million people in those 120 cities.
Now, you're here at the Michigan Agribusiness Association Conference, and you're going to be talking to folks who are in the agricultural industry. A little bit about what you're going to tell them. I would imagine you would focus on the importance of partnerships among agricultural, environmental, and urban mayor groups.
Well, partnerships are the name of the game these days. There's far too much political divisions and economic divisions and other divisions, and our organization really wants to reach out and partner with anyone and everyone who wants to solve problems and make life better. We actually have a much greater convergence of interests between the agricultural community and the urban community than I think people really realize. I'm going to use the term natural alliance today. Whether it's the food that we live on, growing in cities and growing up in cities, or the kinds of things we produce, whether it's tractors or fertilizers or IT equipment or whatever, the agricultural community relies on that. So what I would really like to do today is expand the building of bridges between the different interests. Far too quickly, we're put at odds with one another, and that is very counterproductive.
There was a time, and you know this, 30 years ago, when you couldn't get these groups in the same room together.
Yes, I experienced a great deal of that. I truly felt that I was from the government and I was there to help. Many people didn't believe that, but by the end of the time we had our discussions, I think people were realizing that, in fact, we really were interested in solving problems. And this was 40 years ago. It was a sea change in terms of how the American public looked at the issue of the environment. And it was too much of a battle of extremes at that point. And a lot of this is all about finding the middle ground. And from the very beginning in 1973, when I walked into US EPA, I looked at it. I was a lawyer, but it was the environmental problem-solving business. So that's what I've been trying to do for the last 42 years of my life.
Yeah, you know, and this coming together, I mean, what better catalyst? We can argue about different environmental issues, but it seems like water. When you start talking about water, you all of a sudden you get a huge bipartisan buy-in because it affects all of us in such vital ways.
I think water may actually have magnetic properties. People are drawn to water. I live in Chicago with another, 3 million people roughly. And you wouldn't believe the lakefront in the summertime. And we're hoping in the not-too-distant future the riverfront as well. Farmers need water not only for their families but obviously for their crops as well. And this is a common interest. And here in the Great Lakes Basin, we are sitting on a global treasure. And as time goes on, I think it's going to become even more valuable. We see what's happening in California with the wildfires and the droughts and the southeastern part of the United States as well. And all over the world, the abundance of fresh water that we have is something that just can't be matched and I think is going to be much more important than oil or gold in the future.
My guest is David Ulrich. He's the executive director of the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. I refer to water as liquid gold as well from time to time on this program. David, I would be remiss. We talked to Mayor Hartwell. You mentioned him earlier in the interview. Just got back from the Paris Climate Summit. You were there as well. I'd like to get reactions from people who've been to Paris. I mean, when you came back, what were you feeling? What were you thinking?
Well, first, let me start with a lot of people questioned whether or not I should go to Paris because of the terrorism threat. And my own personal feeling on that is that if we let the terrorists bring the world to a halt, they will have won. This issue of climate change is a major thing that we have to deal with as a planet. And if we're going to not participate because of a fear of terrorism, they will have won, and I did not want that to happen. Secondly, I almost think that the fact that those terrorist attacks that occurred on November 13th created a feeling of even greater solidarity among the people. And that word solidarity was used many times in the meetings that I was sitting in on. So it created even greater solidarity in terms of coming up with solutions to the climate change problems that we have. Third, and the focus of a lot of my work over there, as well as Mayor Hartwell, is what can local governments do to help solve this problem? With over 50% of the world's population in urban areas, and those areas being responsible for over 70% of the emissions, we have a major role to play. Frankly, I think there was some skepticism as to whether the national governments would come up with solutions. We're very, very pleased that they have, and we think that it will help. However, cities, and there were over 450 cities represented at a meeting hosted by Mayor Bloomberg, former Mayor Bloomberg, and the mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, over 450 mayors were there and basically said, regardless of the outcome, we're going ahead. This is, as many people said, an existential issue. The future of the planet is really in our hands, and we need to start today on solving those problems. Michael Bloomberg said the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago, and the second best is today. So we're starting to plant trees.
We have to wrap up the interview. We could talk for all afternoon and all morning about some of these issues. But looking forward to the next year or two, what are a couple of the key issues that you're going to be focusing on?
Well, a big one and why I'm here today is nutrients and how we in the agricultural and private sector and non-government sector can come together, particularly in this area of the western basin of Lake Erie. It's kind of ground zero for nutrient and algal growth problems, but I'm confident that among Ohio, Michigan, and Ontario, we can come up with real creative solutions to these problems. So that's really the biggest one, one of the biggest ones. And then secondly, climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, adaptation, resilience to climate change is a huge issue as well. Third, invasive species. The Asian carp is still knocking on the door, and we've got to make sure it does not get into the Great Lakes. So those are three things that keep me very busy. They don't keep me awake at night, but they keep me very busy.
Well, they keep us busy because those are three areas that we continue to focus on this radio program, and those are certainly salient issues going forward. I've been talking with David Ulrich. He's the executive director of the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. David, welcome to Michigan again, and thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for all your hospitality.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Kirk Heinze is broadcasting Greening of the Great Lakes from the Michigan Agribusiness Association's annual winter conference. And here he is with more.
Well, Russ and I are on site for the Michigan Agribusiness Association's Water Symposium. And another guest, another speaker on the program is John Burge. John comes to us from Nebraska, and he leads the North Platte Natural Resources District in Nebraska. He's talking with the group about the situation with the Ogallala Aquifer. First of all, John, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
John, tell us a little bit. North Platte Natural Resources District, that's a huge responsibility. Give us some sense of the size of the district and what it is that you folks do.
Well, I think here in Michigan, you guys have conservation districts. This is very similar to that. In Nebraska, we created a unique system called natural resources districts about 40 years ago. The legislature created these, and they're tax authorities. They are political subdivisions. We collect money through property tax, amongst other revenue streams, in order to do a variety of different things that they have charged us with. Probably the most important is the management of the quality and quantity of groundwater.
In addition to water, and we're going to focus on that, but you have responsibilities related to land use, interface with agriculture, I mean, a wide array of responsibilities over that vast territory.
Yeah, we do, and we're one of 23 districts in Nebraska. Ours is about 3.5 million acres. We have about 500,000 of those acres that are irrigated. The vast majority then are pasture or dryland farming. And our biggest challenge, which we'll get into here shortly, is dealing with the quantity issues. About 10 years ago, the legislature passed a law that designated much of our district as over-appropriated or overdeveloped in terms of groundwater irrigation. So we've had to wrestle with the different ways that we could become more efficient, raise different kind of crops, do some drought tolerance in order to keep our ag economy strong, but also to recognize that we've got to return water back to the North Platte River.
Well, let's talk about the situation with the Ogallala Aquifer. I think a lot of our listeners may not know that it is twice as large, if you look at it, as all of the Great Lakes combined, which was a staggering piece of data when I came across that. But parts of the aquifer are in trouble, but parts look like they're in pretty good shape, particularly maybe in Nebraska. But give us a snapshot of the situation with the Ogallala.
Well, to be fair, everything's better in Nebraska. But one of the things that I would say is if you look at what's gone on, particularly in western Kansas or northwestern Texas, if you look at that stretch of the aquifer where you have seen dramatic droppage in the elevation of water, you know that that is not an unlimited source. You also know that the recharge of that aquifer, those very deep aquifers, takes a tremendous amount of time. Think about this for a moment. There's actually a credible proposal, or people are deeming it as credible, to divert water from the Missouri River to western Kansas in order to maintain that, you know, quote-unquote Garden of Eden. There's also, just to take that one step further, there's a relatively credible proposal to take water from the upper reaches of the Missouri River up in North Dakota and pipe those to Las Vegas. I mean, people are moving water tremendous distances in order to maintain either an ag economy in the case of western Kansas or a metropolis that continues to grow in the case of Las Vegas. And what we have seen with the aquifer in Nebraska is we are not in that bad of shape, but it could come. You know, we've got people in California that are mining 20,000-year-old water out of the aquifer. This is something that is very real and should be a cautionary tale for all of us. It doesn't matter if you have 800 feet of saturated thickness under your feet. Eventually, that water can go. And when that water goes, we need to be prepared for it. We need to figure out ways to mitigate the problem before it comes a real problem for us. Our board, we have a member of our board who said something that I thought was exceedingly bright, and that was that you cannot plan for a drought in the middle of a drought. You have to plan for a drought before it. 2 years ago, we got 6 inches of rain. In our neck of the woods, the crop irrigation requirement for a corn crop is 24 inches. So you've got to make up that 18 inches somehow. Our district allocates irrigation water to 14 inches, so now you're at 20. So if you're reducing yields because you have 6 inches less of water available, you're going to have a devastating impact on your economy, devastating impact on all of those resulting economies around agriculture. So that's what we've been focused on, is trying to figure out a way to deal with the problems as they come up, but also deal with the overdeveloped problem that the legislature defined for us a few years ago.
My guest is John Burge. He is the general manager of the North Platte Natural Resources District, located in Scottsbluff, Nebraska. John, with respect to the aquifer, I know that somewhat different from the Great Lakes and the surface water, but the recharge of an aquifer can take millennia.
Well, it can. In our district, we have both deep Ogallala, and then we have Arickaree, and we also have alluvium. We rely probably the most on the alluvium. The alluvium is recharged by the North Platte system. Just to give you a sense, we've got a a stretch of river out there that was developed about 110 years ago by the Bureau of Reclamation. It was the second reclamation project in the country. And that created the North Platte Project. And that was a series of five dams creating very large reservoirs in Wyoming. And with those reservoirs in Wyoming, we get about 75% of that water coming into Nebraska for irrigation purposes. We have 26 irrigation districts in our district, which makes us relatively unique. And it also allows for a lot of leakage into our aquifer system. That's important because of what you're talking about. If we did not have that irrigation system in western Nebraska, we wouldn't have that kind of recharge. We wouldn't have all of those porous holes leaking back into not only the alluvium, but into the more shallow parts and then also the deeper parts of the Ogallala. As you get further east in Nebraska, you run out of those surface water districts. So all of what recharges is either through the river system or through precipitation. Now, luckily, in eastern Nebraska, they get about what you guys get. They get somewhere in between 30 and 40 inches of rain. So they do have a lot of runoff, but controlling that runoff and making sure that it is intentionally recharged, either through some sort of reservoir system or some sort of inefficient irrigation on the ground, is very, very much key in terms of recharge. We do a lot of monitoring in our district. We have 800 monitoring wells just in our 4.5 counties of Nebraska. I like to say that that's more than the state of Georgia. It's many ways that we are better than Georgia. But I will say that when we do levels, and we do levels three times a year to determine what kind of drawdown and recharge we're getting, we have found that when we're closer to, obviously, when you're closer to riparian areas or to river areas, you're going to see a much quicker response time in terms of recharge than you would elsewhere. We're lucky in Nebraska. We've got a lot of rivers. Like I said, we have 23 basins. That's what the NRDs are named after. But many of those are relying on snowpack. In our system, the North Platte system is dependent upon the northern Colorado and southern Wyoming Rockies. And they have experienced a great deal of beetle kill. So you have snow that is melting faster. We don't have as much snowpack as we used to. You know, 3 years ago, at this time of year, we had 150% of normal. Today, we have 81% of normal in snowpack. So we know that there is going to be less water going into the system to begin with. And we've got to keep that in mind as we talk about recharge, because it isn't just about rain falling from the sky. It's about that importation of snowpack that eventually melts.
We got about a minute left here, but you're in Michigan, John, and we're talking about a water symposium. Michigan has similar. We have aquifers. A lot of people don't know that. They think all we have are the Great Lakes. What are some things, though, that you've learned in Nebraska that you think are applicable to Michigan's situation?
Well, I think one of the things that we need to be cognizant of, even though you all aren't experiencing the same kind of shortage that we're experiencing, is you've got to focus on two things. You've got to focus on maintaining the quality of that water. But most importantly, at least from my perspective, is you've got to focus on maintaining the quantity of that water. And to do that, you've got to start asking your landowners who want to be partners in this to make reductions in their use now. We've got an allocation in place. We allocate water. Yields have not diminished. In fact, they've gone up. We've got technological advances, different types of tillage practices, all of those things that are happening that have not reduced yields but have reduced water use. We are actively seeking to get land out of production that probably never should have been put in. You know, we were the Great American Desert before the North Platte Project, and we still got parts of that that should continue to be the Great American Desert. So we're seeking those lands as well. We work with our federal partners on various different conservation programs to make sure that we are ensuring quantity. And then on the quality side, we're controlling a lot of nitrogen. I know you guys have a phosphorus problem up here. We've got the same problem with nitrates in our water, and controlling the amount of application is very important as well. I wish we had more time. I'd tell you more, but I appreciate it.
Well, no, a lot of similarities there, and I think your point that you made earlier in the interview was that you don't wait for a drought to start taking these proactive steps. I think Michigan and Nebraska are definitely on the same page when it comes to that. I've been talking with John Burge. He's the general manager of the North Platte Natural Resources District in Scottsbluff, Nebraska. John, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Kirk Heinze is broadcasting from the Michigan Agribusiness Association's Winter Conference. Here's Kirk with more.
Well, another participant at the Water Symposium that's hosted by the Michigan Agribusiness Association is Stephen Beckley. Stephen is the principal of S. Beckley & Associates based in Woodland, California. He's an expert on California water issues. Steve, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. I don't know if I'm an expert, but in California, in agriculture, you better know about water and where the quantity and also what's going on in quality.
Well, we've tracked the California water situation on this program now for several years. I remember one of our guests saying that the California water situation was kind of like the bald man with the big beard, not so much quantity but distribution. Is that accurate? And where are we in the water situation in California now?
Well, the water situation's still tough in California. Like I say, I'm really excited. It's raining. We've had some good snow this fall, but our storage is way low. Our water system depends on about 70% of the water coming from surface water in California, and the rest coming from groundwater.
Steve, this has had the drought's had a devastating impact on agriculture. I don't need to tell you that, but in general, I mean, where are the farmers now? Obviously, hoping for more irrigation and more rain. But it has been tough.
It's not only been tough on the farmers. It's really been tough on the farm workers. We're like Michigan. We use a lot of farm workers to pick our crops. It's been tough, but we've also survived it and made do.
I know in some urban areas of California, there's water rationing going on. A lot of folks are planting indigenous lawns, things of that nature. What is the relationship between the agricultural interests and the urban and commercial interests now with respect to water management?
Well, I think, number one, the urban areas, the governor asked everybody to conserve 20%, and we've reached his goal. The great news is I don't have a lawn to mow. It's just I got to go out there and make sure it isn't too dusty. But people have responded to help conserve water. The relationship is, in many areas, everybody's pulling together, environmental, ag, and urban, that to solve this problem, to save when we have to save, and know that we've got to develop a water system that can meet the future needs of all three. And as I say, all three, that's agriculture, urban, and very important is the environment, the fish and our birds and other things in California.
Steve, looking forward, you're talking about this collaboration and cooperation. I mean, what are some steps that you think that California needs to take moving forward?
Well, I think we've started making the steps. Number one, we've got to learn how to make it rain and snow, and I don't think that's in our thing. So together, the citizens of California last year passed a proposition offering so many billion dollars for water projects, conservation, and other things, and that will come into play in the beginning of 2017. I think we also need to take a look at our options for more storage. There's two dams on the on the drawing board that we're hoping to get funding from this Proposition 1 last year, Temperance Flat in the San Joaquin Valley, and Sites Reservoir up in the north. Sites, and I think Temperance Flat, I'm more of an expert on Sites because it's one of the groups, several groups I work with are very involved in making it reality. And that will take water that right now is probably flowing out to the ocean or flowing out the delta, and it's called off-site storage. It's not damming any streams, but we'd be pumping it up into sites right now and have it for future use.
My guest is Stephen Beckley. He's the principal of S. Beckley & Associates, based in California, expert on California water issues. Some of our previous guests have mentioned things like desalinization plants and other very expensive fixes for some of these issues. Desalinization part of the future of water management in California?
It certainly spoke of. I had the privilege of spending Christmas in San Diego, where the weather is a little bit different than here, and they just opened a desalination plant down there. And one thing they were saying, the bureaucracy and the regulations tied them up so much in getting it done, getting it together, that it may never be profitable. It seems that that would certainly be a way. I think it's some other ways, other countries' way, because it's probably got more opportunity to do desalination than getting a pipeline from the lakes here. But it's a challenge. And you look out those beautiful oceans and think, why can't we do that? And I know Santa Barbara has a plant. They put one in the San Diego. But I'm not sure anywhere with agriculture is benefiting from that.
As we look at the water issues in California, you're here in Michigan at the Water Symposium that's being sponsored by the Michigan Agribusiness Association. What are some things that Michigan can learn from California's situation?
I think the main thing is plan ahead. You say I'm an expert. I'm not really an expert but I work with a lot of experts. And I was telling my wife the other day, I may be getting a little older and I don't want to go to a lot of meetings. I'm out here because Jim Byram's a good friend of mine. But it is to plan ahead and try to work together and look for non-traditional partners. One of the groups I work with is the Rice and Reclamation District 108. They have partnership with so many environmental groups, bringing urban people up to educate why Northern California is important on water, why we need the Sites Reservoir. And I know the people down south are trying to do that also. And I think that's the main thing. And I've told my wife, I am just so happy that we got a lot of people younger than me that are working on this thing 24 hours a day almost. My neighbor's involved in a lot of this, and I never see him home, and he's not farming. He's going to a meeting on water. And that's the real message, is plan to get it together and look for non-traditional partners, because we're all in this together. As I said, the governor has asked people to cut back 20%. Agriculture's cut back. It scares me. In my country, again, Northern California, we like to have around 300,000 acres flooded for the wildlife, wild birds right now. And we're only about 150,000 acres. And that impacts the hunting. That impacts the birds coming to California. And we want the birds back. So it's work together and plan ahead is my message.
You know, Steve, Jim's probably talking. You mentioned Jim Byram, who kicked off this program. Jim's the president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. But he's very interested in those sorts of coalitions with respect to Great Lakes water problems, urban, environmental, agriculture working together, pulling people on the same page to preserve these wonderful resources that we have.
Yeah, no, I think it's very important. And I'll tell you, the first meetings you're always going to have with people that don't have the same opinion. You're going to sit across the table and stare, what am I doing in this room? But you got to get to know them, you know. And I know some of our partners like Ducks Unlimited, the Nature Conservatory, and they all really, when you get thinking about it, they want the same thing we want, is a good environment. And they're starting to realize that the farmers are a key to a good environment, that I'd rather have a piece of ground managed by a farmer than the government any day.
Well, as we like to say on this program, farmers and agricultural producers were the original green movement and have always been concerned about stewardship of land and water.
Yeah, I certainly agree. And a lot of times it's taken a while to educate our partners. And I do call them partners, that we're all in this together, because I'm going to go back to the rice. So we were down 25% in acreage in rice last year. That's not much rice when we raise a half million acres of rice in California. But to my small towns where I'm from, up in Yolo, Colusa, Glen, and those counties, it's economically devastating, because a lot of jobs are gone there. And it's important that we get that ground back in production, not only for those towns, but like I say, the birds love it. We got to have the water flowing down the rivers for the fish. We've done some collaborative projects with environmentalists and putting in fish screen, because salmon, we love them. We want them to prosper, but sometimes they're not the smartest fish in the world, and they try to go up some canal or something, and they land up dying, and we want them to get out the ocean so they can spawn or get up to the Shasta where they spawn there. So it's really important that we educate each other. And sometimes we think most environmentalist groups are just left wing out there, you know, want to shut us down. And most all they want to have is a good environment. Unfortunately, there are some groups we're unable to partner with just because they have a little bit different view. But the majority of them are great partners. And a lot of times they know how to make things happen even better than we do as farmers.
One of the great lessons from the California experience, partnerships, partnerships, partnerships. I've been talking with Stephen Beckley. He's a principal of S. Beckley & Associates based in Woodland, California. Steve, a pleasure having you on the program.
Well, it certainly is a pleasure. And I told Jim, next time, invite me to the summer meeting.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, conservation and good ecology are always part and parcel of discussions about agriculture these days, particularly when it comes to water and water quality. Here to talk to us a little bit about that, Dr. Tim Boring. Tim is the Vice President of our good friends at the Michigan Agribusiness Association. And in particular, we're going to talk about a certified applicator program, which we're probably going to have to explain to our listeners. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
First of all, a little bit about the Michigan Agribusiness Association and the certified applicator program.
Yeah, so the Michigan Agribusiness Association is made up of about 500 member companies, and we really represent a lot of the agribusinesses you see out there in the landscape working with producers on growing crops in Michigan. So we work with the input suppliers, the folks that are supplying the seeds, that are supplying crop protection materials, supplying fertilizers, and a number of other partners throughout the value chain here. So with the certified fertilizer applicator program we're talking about here today, that we've really over the last 6 months or so have worked on developing out the and formalizing to some extent of a lot of the training mechanisms we have for the folks employed by these agribusinesses that are out there working with producers that are applying crop inputs on fields. So a lot of our efforts have been focused on the fertilizer aspect piece of this, and certainly water quality is a huge issue for us. We're involved in a lot of different areas of this, of trying to improve some of the management the producers do, better understanding some of the challenges really going on with this, but working then with our partners that are the guys out there applying things in the field about making sure that they're absolutely doing things the best way, they're safe on the roads, they're following all the proper procedures, things like this. So really kind of formalizing and publicly recognizing a lot of the existing training programs we already have out there in the industry.
Now, you use the word applicator. I'm going to take this from our listeners' perspective. And as a kid growing up, farmers out there spraying their fields or spreading fertilizer, but also pesticides, herbicides. For a long time, some of that use was not as scientifically based, quite frankly, as it is now. Talk a little bit about the historical perspective on application and spraying, where we were then and where we are now.
Yeah, so it's really an interesting history. And if you stop and think about it, it's not that long of a history. That certainly some of the professors that I studied under at Michigan State University, they saw the entire advent of the herbicide spectrum within the industry. That we really only developed herbicides to go in commercial fertilizers after World War II, really. A lot of the stuff exploded then. So certainly our understanding of the chemistry and how we make these products has evolved a lot. Things have gotten tremendously safer, that we don't use a lot of the compounds we used 20, 30 years ago. So our compounds are a lot safer. Our understanding of how to use those in the best means possible really has improved a lot. And then we've also improved a lot of how we can deliver these things out of the landscape. So the rigs out there running in farmers' fields cost $300,000. There's a lot of technology that goes into these sorts of things. They're all auto-steered. They're all multi-sectional kind of booms. Really precision fertilizer and pesticide placement on a lot of this stuff. And the technology is running so fast with this sort of thing. We keep evolving what we can do with this stuff. I mean, the applicators sometimes are pulling out their hair. Of every 6 months, we're coming out with new technologies of things to put in these rigs. But there's a lot of benefits to it, and there's always the grumbling of we get used to it, and then, 3 weeks later, we can't live without it. But we're improving where we place the stuff, how we place it, how accurate it is. There's just so many benefits to the role of technology and the improvement of our management in these systems.
Well, even from layman's terms, I've been in a couple of these sprayers with friends of mine who are agricultural producers with this satellite technology. But essentially, the plants are getting exactly what they need to grow and to produce the yields that we're looking for. And then there's nothing left for runoff into some of our waters. And that's particularly relevant given some of the problems we have in our Great Lakes right now, especially Lake Erie.
Oh, absolutely. So we're spending a lot of time, and we've worked on this for a long time, of tailoring the rates of fertilizer, right? Of making sure that we're putting on exactly how much the plant's going to need. And our technological abilities keep improving of where we can place it into the system. Some of this newest technology will allow you to run through the field and tasseling corn at 10, 12, 15 miles an hour and place it within like an inch of a corn plant. So, and that really brings up this other piece that we're getting better and better about all the time as well, of timing nutrient supply to crop demand. So it used to be that we applied a lot of these fertilizers before the crop came up. Just once the crop starts coming up, you can't get in there with equipment. I mean, this corn's 15 feet tall sometimes. So you're really limited in what you can do to get in there. We've certainly developed new equipment. Our airplanes and helicopters are a lot better about doing some of this sort of stuff. So we'll be in there of all season long applying crop protection materials, fertilizer materials, to try to deliver things specifically when the plant needs them. And the end goal of that is the fact you're just using less product. So there's an economic savings there. There's certainly environmental. We're really lowering risks with that.
Yeah, a classic case. I'm talking with Dr. Tim Boring. He's the vice president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. But a classic case about what's good for the environment is also good for the bottom line. And we're seeing more and more of those examples. You mentioned some of the new technologies, and I know there's some fuzziness around drone technology. But the potential for drones to make that applicator, some of these applications, even more precise is immense.
Oh, yeah. It's This tends to be a popular topic when you start talking to kind of these cutting-edge producer groups and the cutting-edge agronomy applicator community. If you think about it, and I farm a little bit myself, if I talk to some of our neighbors who are 80 years old or so, they remember their fathers farming with horses. And you think about where we are today of the fact that we have these huge applicators out there in the fields, self-driving themselves, everything is automatically controlled. And these are the same guys that grew up with horses on the farm. And you think about that span of technology of where we're going to be when the current kid that's out there is 16, 18 years old that's on dad's tractor, where are we going to be when he's 80 years old? So there's all these – a lot of concerns of how we best leverage that technology. And really I think we're getting a lot better with kind of our regulation of what the drones are going to be doing. We're certainly at this point, the only thing we're using drones for is basically to go up and take pictures and do a better job of figuring out exactly the status of the crop, where we're at in the season. But where do we go in another 10, 20, 30 years on this? It's really exciting for what we might be able to leverage technology like that with to completely change our paradigm of how we can produce plants.
Tim, we've got about a minute left, but let's come back to the actual certified applicator program. What is it that these applicators essentially have to do to get certified? I imagine it's a pretty rigorous process.
Yeah, it's fairly rigorous. And really, this isn't a lot of stuff that they're not already doing. We're formalizing a little bit about this and putting it in a better package that we can really tell the public about the things we're doing. So we've just been hosting our annual winter conference here in Lansing, and we spent an entire day on Monday walking through a lot of the training with applicators. So it's going through things like making sure equipment is properly calibrated, everything is within specs, understanding of how we work around water bodies near fields. But it's also things like on-the-road safety. It's what happens if emergencies happen. Who do you call? What are the steps you take? And certainly I'm sure a lot of your listeners, especially in rural areas, will see these applicators out on the road. These guys are not just driving around here willy-nilly, highly trained people. They really know how to operate the rigs that they're in, both in the field, on the road. But we're looking really to be able to tell the public a little bit more about really what those certifications are and reassuring people that the fact that when you see these folks in the fields and on the roads, these are professionals out here that really have a lot of training behind them.
Well, I think that's the take-home message. And I think you might agree with me, Tim, that public awareness of what's going on in agriculture has never been more important. And the Michigan Agribusiness Association is committed to greater public awareness, not only in pest applicator or pesticide application, fertilizer application, but across the board in terms of nutrient management.
Most definitely. I mean, food is something that everyone eats, and everyone has everyone has a complete right to understand all the things going on to this, that we're not really out here to be hiding anything. And sometimes kind of the nuances of how we run this industry are pretty boring. But at the same time, we're committed here to having this as transparent as possible, and we're happy to answer any questions people have about how we're growing their food.
So transparency and the application of fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides, transparency in general. I've been talking with Dr. Tim Boring. He's the vice president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. Tim, always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
I'm Scott Westerman from the Michigan State University Alumni Association with another observation from the Spartan Life. The key, says Stephen Covey, is not in spending time, but investing it. You are a person of value. Your quality time is limited, so it's essential that you invest most of it in people who appreciate and reciprocate. Keith Ferrazzi tells us that the only true way to get a return on a relationship investment is to give without the expectation of return. That's great advice, but it's also true that your own soul must have nourishment if it is to have the strength to make a difference in the world. So make sure your portfolio of friends has more than a few reciprocators in it. Our lives are filled with transactional relationships. We pay for something, they provide it, and that's the end of the transaction. People mumble, "Thanks for your business," and "Have a great day" after we've handed over the cash and they hand over the hamburgers, but they don't really mean it. That's not reciprocation. The places we return to time and again are populated with authentic souls who genuinely are interested in us, who are proactive in their interactions, who make us feel like what we do for them really means something, who reflect back the positive energy we try to share, even on the rare occasions when our own energy level is low. This is reciprocation. Reciprocation does not always mean appreciation. The best feedback is honest feedback. Sometimes that hurts. But if it comes from a place of affection, you will ultimately be glad you got it. One of my all-time most popular Monday motivators talks about the importance of de-emphasizing unfulfilling relationships and prioritizing people who care. This is a key to personal growth and chasing happiness. Treat everyone as you want to be treated, but over the long haul, don't invest in people who don't appreciate it. It's okay to give without expecting a return, but not all the time. Long-term relationships don't work if you're the only one who is doing the heavy lifting. People who don't reciprocate aren't necessarily bad people. They may have something going on inside that you don't know about. They may have other priorities, or they might just not be that into you. That's okay. If it feels like a temporary thing, hang in there. If it's a pattern, let them go. You will get some time back to spend on someone else who appreciates you. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans A.D. Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear the show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.